from the underground.
Welcome back to the Sports Hub Underground. This is Matt Dolliff. I am here with Ty Anderson, as we are every single week at 985thesportshub.com. Ty, hi, how are you?
What's going on?
Good. What's going on? Good. That's classic. That's classic me right there. Yeah, we're doing another Zoom episode. You can probably tell already. There are some shenanigans going on at that new building, Ty.
That's what I hear.
They're coming into the office like, yeah, sorry, we got to shut off the internet. I don't know. It's like, what? Yeah, no, that's fine. I don't need the internet to do my job. But yeah, going through some growing pains at the new building, I guess.
So gremlins
or Zoom for a little while. But I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Hanging out, man. We got Patriots are starting here. We got the Bruins start next week. You know, there's a Bruins game, a preseason game next weekend. Not this Saturday, but the one after. There's a preseason game next Saturday.
I think I saw that Bruins tweeted, like, their Twitter account said something about the preseason next week. And I was like, wait, what?
Right.
Like, it was Nesson or something. But, yeah, now that's really creeping up on us. Wait, when is actual training camp? Is that?
So, I don't have an exact date yet. I believe it's the 21st. I think it's off ice is the 20th, and then on ice first day is the 21st.
Is it only, like, 2 weeks?
So basically you have 2 days of practice essentially before you have a game, or 3 days of practice, whatever it is. Like, not a lot of time. It's just you're jumping right into things. So, but you know, I talk to players, I talk to coaches, and sometimes they feel like a 6-game preseason is too long, right? Like, they just need 4 games and they feel ready to go. Other years,
6 games is crazy.
They feel like, okay, 6 is not enough. It all depends, like, you know, your coach implementing a new system. So I think having a new coaching staff, they may need all 6 games really to get a feel for what they have and what they're doing. But it is creeping up though.
Yeah, I guess like
everyone's in town besides Bergeron. Krejci and Pastrnak, by the way. So
really?
Just waiting on them too. And then you got a full roster.
Well, so yeah, I mean, is there anything new on Pastrnak? Not really.
No. I think coming stateside, I think this is going to be an interesting camp. We've talked about this before in terms of getting it done before the end of training camp. That's where all eyes are going to be. That's all anyone's going to talk about. We're all going to be curious. We haven't really talked to Pastrnak, but we've heard a lot of outside external noise, right? About like, oh, he might not want to stay, you know? So to get him back in Boston and to ask him, hey, do you want to be here? I think will be interesting, and we'll see if we get some clarity there. They want to get this done as soon as they can, I think. So we'll see.
That would be nice. Yeah. So you saw Fabian Lysell today though, right? Was it rookies or what was it today?
Yeah, today was actually the first day of rookie camp practice. And this was my first time seeing Lysell in person, since last training camp when he was a kid, you know, 2 months after getting drafted, basically. The kid is good. He's good, man. Like, he has got wheels. He's got some spark to his skating game. I really think he's going to be pro this year. Is it in Boston? I don't know. But there is no point in him going back to the WHL, the OHL, wherever they could stash him, right? Because I think Vancouver
is a pro.
Yeah, I think Vancouver actually filled his spot on their designated European player list. So I don't know if he can go back there or not. I'd have to ask around. But I asked him today. I said, do you know where you're playing next year? And he said, no idea. Just going to see what happens. And so he's really coming in and just saying, like, he wants to be a pro. He wants to play here. And he's got the jump, man. He's a really exciting prospect.
Yeah, I love that. What I like that you said was he's got spark to his skating game, like, in addition to just being fast. Because I always say that. It's like there's a difference between just being fast and being, like, a great skater.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Connor McDavid is, like, so great because he's not just fast, but he's the best skater I've ever seen, in my opinion.
Yeah,
there's a difference.
Yeah, the acceleration there, it feels like there's a lot there. There's a lot of oomph behind his stride. You know, I think a guy like Taylor Hall is an example. Like, you know, like he picks up speed in a hurry. I think Lysell is just, he's just the operating speed that he's at all times is really impressive to me. So I really want to see him in game action. I think he's going to have a good showing at this prospect challenge up in Buffalo, but you know, you got a little bit of a teaser as to what's to come here with the line that he could begin his pro career in Providence with. He was with Jacob Lacko and Georgi Merkulov. Merkulov's another high offensive ceiling, high motor kind of player. So the Providence Bruins could be going for just speed and skill all up and down that line. So might be a sneak preview there who's going to be playing with. So a lot to like about that.
Do you think there's a good chance that Lysell's actually – I mean, he's good enough to be like – to actually spark a conversation of can they fit him in the top six in Boston, or like can they give him a prominent role in Boston on or sooner than we think? You think he could put on that kind of performance where like our friends are 2-6 or like demanding that the Bruins play him because they finally have this kid who could skate and has some skill?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because there's really not an open spot for him right now. If you're going to play him, don't play him on the fourth line. You know, third line would be fine, but you have Craig Smith right now.
Right. That's why I said top six, because it's like not even bottom six is out of the question for a player.
No,
like him.
No, I don't see the opening right now.
Providence, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think right now it's play 18 minutes a night down in Providence.
Yeah.
You know, learn the ins and outs of the pro game, learn what you're going to be going against every night. And we'll reassess in December or January. Like keep in mind, like they do have to make a trade at some point to become fully cap compliant once they get McAvoy, Grizzlick, and Marchand back. Now, the flip side is they may never get those guys back and be fully healthy, right? Like, you never know. Like, you can get one of those guys back and then Carlo's out or Coyle's out. You know what I mean? There's so many different ways it can go. But if he's lighting it up in the AHL and Craig Smith is struggling, do you say, okay, let's move Craig Smith and let's free up that spot for Fabian Lysell and let's see what he has? Like, that could be something that they look at as well. So I don't think he's here to begin the year. It would have to take something undeniable. And even then it's like, is that enough? Right. So I think they're going to be patient with him, but he could make the conversation interesting this year. If what I saw today is what he is all the time, which again, rookie can't practice, who knows, but if he's that guy consistently, it's going to be hard not to keep him on your roster.
Yeah, I know. I mean, like if he can prove it at the pro level, I don't think it will be long until they're giving him the call up, if only to give in to the pressure, you know, from guys like us. I mean, I don't know how much they actually listen to us, but you know, if there's enough pressure.
But they got a lot of guys though. I think forwards especially who could challenge for spots this year. Like we saw Mark McLaughlin last year. We know he can be a solid fourth liner. He plays center and wing, so that helps him. You know, Johnny Beecher, if he can be what he was when they wanted to draft him, right? Like, or when they drafted him before he got bogged down in Michigan down the depth chart. If he can play with the offensive flair that he had when he came to Providence out of Michigan last year, he could force the issue too. Now, I bring up Beecher because they don't really have a lot of left-handed centermen coming up in the system. You look at their roster with a lot of righty shots. You know, Thomas Nosek's job security is there really because he's a left shooting center option. He's a left face-off option. So if Beecher can progress in the face-off game, win some draws, prove he can play the two-way game, you know, a lot is asked out of you to be a center in the Bruins organization. If he can do that, okay, now does he challenge as well? Like, does he get his call? So there's a lot of guys that got down there, I think, who can maybe make a push. You know, I mentioned Merkulov. This kid can play too. If he can learn how to play defense, he's another guy as well. So
wait, is that a kid they just drafted this year?
He was an undrafted free agent signing out of Ohio State. Fantastic scorer in the Big Ten. Really was basically behind the Michigan, you know, superstar team that they had there in terms of goal scoring and offensive prowess. So he's a guy that I talk to people and they say that they may have found something here. So he's another one. So they got guys. It's just, okay, how can they push and can they really make things interesting, make a guy sweat in camp?
What do you know? They look outside of the Cape Cod League and they finally start finding some players, you know?
That's right. That's right.
Can we circle back to the trade part? I think we talked about it before, but like, who do you think, like, let's reset that. Who could possibly be traded out of here? Like, as far as someone they have to trade off the roster to get under the cap.
Yeah. So it all depends how much money they need to move out. It all depends how guys are playing. I think at that point, you know, a guy like Nick Foligno, I don't think is an option. I don't think that you're going to be able to move him. And I think the players, listen, it pains people to hear this. I know because he's not as productive as his nearly $4 million salary says, but, you know, players like playing with him. Like, he's a good locker room guy, right? And so I don't think they want to trade him personally. It's just my, like, they're going to give him a run here and see if he still has anything in the tank. He's healthy, which is nice. Mike Riley makes the most sense to me just because he was not happy being a scratch last year. You look at where they were or where they are depth-wise there. I don't see them trading Grizzlick. Forbert, I don't see them trading him either. He has a modified no trade as well, I believe. So it becomes harder to trade him a little bit. So Riley's a guy who I just think it makes the most sense because he wasn't happy not playing regularly last year. And when you're fully healthy, is he in your regular lineup? I don't know. So I look on the back end, but the flip side of that, though, is that the Bruins don't really want to move a defenseman because Don Sweeney has said it again and again. He's like, we go through defensemen every postseason. I'd rather not lose a defenseman.
Right, yeah.
So this is where, and not to bring in a whole new topic here, but this is where the Chara thing is interesting to me. Because if you move the defenseman, let's just say, right? Let's just say you moved one of your $3 million defensemen, and Chara's unsigned, but he's in shape. Are you like, hey, do you want to come back for league minimum and be the eighth defenseman and just be a depth guy? Like, I'd wonder, right? They brought in Tuukka. They brought Tuukka back knowing that he was a complete wild card and they were going to have a three-goalie rotation. It's like, okay, did they do look at that with Chara?
I'd take him back if it was something like that.
Right. So,
I mean, like, this is why I got to take notes before the show, Ty. I got to write stuff down.
Yeah,
I would have forgotten to ask you about Chara, but it just seems like they wouldn't. They're not going to do. It seemed like he was just stopping in saying hi, you know. And the fact that he's in shape doesn't surprise me because he's known for a guy that's being like always in ridiculous shape, like a workout freak. So I mean, like that part doesn't surprise me. But like I don't know, he still wants to play. Like, does it sound like he's still going to be kicking around, or is
I have
retirement's even been bandied about with him?
So I my understanding is that if a team comes calling, he would listen. I don't think that he wants to stop playing. I mean, dude, he played 72 games last year for the Islanders, and he averaged 18 minutes a night. Now, it was a lot of PK work for him. It wasn't a lot of five-on-five work, but he played a lot last year, right? He still wants to play.
I'll take him on the PK for sure.
So, you know, I do wonder if he's out of gas. There were games last year I watched him and I was like, ugh, this is not looking good.
He has to be. Is he 45 now?
He's 45. He turns 46 in March.
Oh, my next God. Year. He's going to be. So if he plays for a team next year, he will be
46. Yes.
He'll be a 46 year old professional hockey player. So, I mean, like, you will really only have so much in the tank at that age. Let's be honest.
But think about it.
I'd take it back if he accepted the role that you laid out. Eighth defense. What would he? So he'd be on the ninth floor most games. Like he's not gonna play in the AHL, right?
No, he wouldn't play in the AHL. But like, no. I just think about it. Like, if you're trying to cut costs at the defensive position when you have to make cap room, you make a trade. Let's just say, and could you bring in a guy at prorated league minimum, right? Like you did with Tuukka, and you bring in a guy like Chara or. If it's not Chara, let's just say PK Subban is still unsigned, which I don't think is going to be the case. I think he gets work. But would they look at something like that? I would wonder. I really would, because they want to have a complete team. They want to be as deep as they can be, right? And you look at them defensively, they're deep right now. But if they make a trade, it gets a little dicey. So I'd wonder. I still think the trade comes from the back end. But I think contenders elsewhere on the roster to become cap compliant would be a Craig Smith, would be a Thomas Nosek, depending on how much money you have to clear. So they have options there. It's just a matter of who is the unlucky guy, right, who gets traded out here.
Well,
but it's good. It's good for business. Good for it's good for competition, you know, in-house as well.
That's true. Yeah, but I mean, I don't mind that idea of Mike Riley. Like, because Mike Riley, I don't know necessarily that he'd be unhappy. He said he wasn't happy here last year. So, I mean, I don't mind the idea if they could trade him somewhere, and he makes like over three million, right? So if they could
three mil on the nose,
trade him and then sign someone for $1 million. So I mean, they might just save just enough. I don't know exactly how much they need to save, but
That's the thing. Like, we're gonna have to wait and see how they manage the daily cap. How they there's gonna be probably a lot of paper transactions where if they're not playing, they send one of their guys down to the minors or bring them back up on game day, like just basically banking away cap space. So it's hard to get a full scope of how much money needs to be cleared right now. We just don't know, especially if there's another injury, anything like that. So I don't know where they're going to go with it. I don't even know if they know where they're going to go with it right now. But they do have a rough idea, I think, as to right now the baseline that has to be cleared out.
All right, well, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, who ends up not on the Bruins, I guess, because they're just going to have to do something at some point. What was the other thing I wanted to... Oh, yeah, I saw you tweet about Jacob Zboril.
Mm-hmm.
He's in good shape. Speaking of good shape.
Yeah, yeah. So talking with Ryan Mougenel today, the P. Bruins coach, who's actually here for rookie camp. He's going to coach that team. He mentioned that he saw Jacob Zboril today, and he's like, I didn't recognize him. He's jacked now. He looks real big. So that's good news. You know, Zboril's had a pretty good offseason. You think about it, right? He has a torn ACL in December, undergo surgery. You know, so he's raring to go, right? He wants to be here. He wants to be what he was before he got hurt, right? He was looking good before he got hurt. So I look at that and I say, okay, that's encouraging. They're going to need him. Like, they're going to need him to play pretty well. Think about his role. He's going to be playing the right side probably out of the gate this year. Just makes the most sense. So that's a guy they need to play a big role for them.
I think that's what caught my eye. You said he was playing on the right side to start the year.
Well, it makes the most sense, right? Because Forbort, you don't really want to play on the right side. Mike Riley, you tried it. It was a disaster. I wouldn't go back to that. And then you look at, you know, Grizzly can play the right side, but he's not healthy, A, to begin the year, mm-hmm. and B, you want him on his left side. So you look at their right side depth right now. It's Carlo, Clifton, and then question mark, right? So I look at Zboril and say that's his role. And that's where he was playing before he got hurt. He was playing right side with Mike Riley. So I think that makes the most sense. I think that's where he'll be. Versatility is a big thing with Zboril. It's a huge thing to have him have job security. And if he's looking good and he's skating well, that's big news. That's the thing I worry about, because he wasn't always the best skater to begin with. So I want to see how he looks on the ice in game action, how the knee's holding up, how he's moving out there, because he's a valuable piece of this operation. If they're going to go, you know, if they're going to be what they hope to be this year, they're going to need guys like him to pull their weight.
I'm still have hope for him. I mean, obviously he's not going to live up to the billing of a 13th overall pick ever, but like I think he could still be a solid, you know, NHL defenseman. So
yeah, I feel the same. Anyone. I feel the same. Like, you know, when we saw him in 2021, the pandemic delayed year, you know, they kind of forced the fit. He wasn't ready out of the gate. I was like, this still makes some shaky plays. But I really thought that he was finding his comfort. He was finding what he can and can't do at this level last season before the injury. So I do believe in him. Listen, like to your point, he's never going to be the 13th best player from the 2015 NHL draft. It's just not going to happen. But I think he can be a serviceable NHL defenseman who contributes on a second or a third pairing. And really, that's what you need, right? Like, I think about him. What if you can get him to a point where he's playing with Charlie McAvoy? Like, I'll take that.
Great.
Like, that'd be awesome if he can do that when you're fully healthy. And then you have Lindholm driving his own pairing. And then you have Grizzlick slot into a third pairing kind of role. Like, that's good. That's kind of what you, I think, want to be when 100% fully healthy. So I look at that and say, if Zboril can be anything, you know, if he can be a regular for your team, that's a great sign.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, low-end top pairing defenseman, complimentary top pairing defenseman would be fantastic.
Right. Even if he's just
stacked, it got to that.
If he's just like, in, you know, he's not the guy, McAvoy's the guy, but Zboril is not embarrassing himself out there. He's right. Proving he can hang.
Yeah. If he can be a legit piece, which I still think he can. And like, that's intriguing to me that he added some bulk, you know, maybe he feels like he doesn't hold up physically well enough just to the beating, to the pounding. So, I mean, I'm curious to see if that helps that he's added that weight, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, you know, that's the big thing. Like, you gotta be strong at this level to be a solid NHL defenseman. You gotta be able to, you know, just withstand the punishment, right? So I don't blame him for how he got hurt last year. It's kind of a weird looking injury. But I do want to see how he responds here, because if he can play all 82 for them, takes a lot of pressure off the rest of the roster and how they're going to make some trades and some cap maneuvering.
Oh, dude, 82. I mean, I'll take 70. I'll take 67. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
Anything out of that kid at this point. All right. Is there anything else Bruins related that you wanted to tackle?
I'm developing this in my head.
Always got a developing take, folks. What you got, Todd?
I would, if I were a betting man, I'd put like $20 down on the Bruins winning the division. I would.
Wow.
Because the odds are like they're I think a plus 1100 to win the division, which seems like kind of low.
Plus 1100 seems, yeah, that seems crazy.
So I would throw a little bit of cash at that and see what happens. I'm not saying throw your whole bank account at it.
No,
but
no.
If you got a little pocket change,
lock of the century, Ty Anderson, Bruins to suddenly win the Atlantic Division.
Yeah, well, all right. Let's
But they need other teams to poop. They need the Florida Panthers to poop themselves. Like,
Florida traded Mackenzie Weegar and Jonathan Huberdeau. They got Matthew Tkachuk. I like Matthew Tkachuk. The more I think about it, that's a big loss for them, because what's been their answer for losing Weegar? They brought in Mark Stahl on a PTO. They brought in another guy on a PTO. And another guy, Michael Delzato. And it's like, okay, well, Weegar's one of the best defensemen in the league. Like, so are you going to win? I think Weegar's super good.
Good? One of the best in the league?
Oh, yeah. And I would say he's top 20 in the NHL. That's like not top 10, but like 11, 12. He's around there. He's really good. Fantastic all-around defenseman, in my opinion.
I feel like I always get him confused with a forward who has a similar name.
Yes, you do. And we've been over this. I feel like we have been over this
on this very podcast.
Yes.
But I'm confusing him with a middle six, like right wing or something that has a similar name, but he's like a grinder. So that's why I'm always shocked when you tell me how good Mackenzie Weegar is. But I guess it makes sense because he was part of the Tkachuk trade. So, I mean, he's got to be worth something.
So he's gone, right?
Yeah.
Let's just say like that team, everything went right for them. They had like 20 goal scorers on their fourth line. Like those things tend to not repeat. It's just the odds of how it all is. Now we look at Tampa. Tampa's been to the Cup 3 years in a row. It's fair to at least project that at a certain point they're going to dip a little bit, right? And when I say that, they lost Andre Palat, who was a huge piece of their puzzle. So he's gone.
Oh yeah, they're starting to get gutted.
So that's happening. Toronto, I can't stress this enough, that Toronto is banking on Matt Murray and Ilya Samsonov to be their goaltenders this year. Two guys who have been hot dude for like 2 years now. I don't see it. Unless they're going to win every game 7-6, 6-5, which they could, sure. But I'm looking at this going, the Bruins have a decent chance, in my opinion, of winning this division. Ottawa's good, but I'm not taking them seriously until they upgrade the defense. Like, that defense is not, like, it's Shabbat and then Zaitsev and Artem Zub. And, like, okay,
yeah,
that's
they're
not...
going to score. They're going to score. Yeah, more, but, yeah. Like, how good are they going to be, really?
Yeah, so I'm looking at them, too, and I'm kind of wondering. So I'm giving the Bruins a puncher's chance at winning the division. And I'm looking at them saying, this team might be better than we think. Like, they really might be better than they think, because I'm boiling it down, Matt, to two simple things. They did not get worse. And I look at where they are at key positions. You don't have Eric Halla. You have David Krejci. You don't have Trent Frederick. You have Pavel Zacha. Like, when fully healthy, and you have a full year of Hampus Lindholm, those are three upgrades over where you were a year ago.
What if people think they got worse because of the coaching change? Because they got rid of Cassidy and brought in Jim Montgomery.
So I don't agree with that, because now – Cassidy is a great coach. You're going to have to replace him. But Jim Montgomery is not going to reinvent the wheel here with this team. They're going to play the same defensive zone style. They're going to make some slight tweaks. But really, like, he's just here to, like, kind of just make sure it doesn't fall off. Like, he wants to make sure that doesn't happen. So I think that's going to – and I look at what he did in St. Louis, running their power play, running their forwards transition game. I think he can just help more than he can hurt, my opinion. If they brought in a David Quinn or a Jay Leach, I'd be sitting here going, I don't know. Because I don't know enough about those guys, their sample size. I saw the sample size with Montgomery in Dallas and then in St. Louis. I think he's a good coach. So, again, if you got $10 kicking around, throw him at the Bruins in the division. It's just my take.
I like it. It's a hot take. I'll give you that. Tampa, though, I'll tell you that Tampa, they wouldn't just get rid of Mackenzie Weegar. You know what I mean? That might be the difference between them and Florida. That makes sense. Florida doesn't seem particularly well run. They just seem to have built up some talent. But well,
think about when the Lightning had to get rid of JT Miller, right? Like they got, I believe, a first round pick. I want to say they got two first round picks. And I think they traded them ultimately. They got one first round pick. I'm sorry. But they got a round three pick and a round one pick. And so, you know, that's what good teams do. Like they really find ways to replenish the supply, so to speak, you know? And so I don't know, like I look at Florida, I'm like, do they have the internal pieces to replace a guy like Mackenzie Weegar? Because if you're relying on Del Zotto and Mark Stahl, you're not going to be happy. You're going to say like, oh shit, shouldn't have lost this guy.
Yeah. Mark Stahl or Michael Del Zotto would be a nice addition to Weegar and Aaron Ekblad and the guys they already had. So, I mean, you're not going to replace them with those guys. Okay. Well, no, I love that take, Todd. I feel like you might be the only person in Boston that feels that way. I think enough people are going to be convinced that getting rid of Cassidy was the wrong move, and they're going to take a step back just because of that. I think no matter what you tell them about the roster, which I think are fair points, I think people are just going to look at it and be like, Cassidy's gone. They had a good thing going, and now they're going to ruin it. I mean, that's just what I think people are going to think overall.
But, yeah.
You know, well, they could be proven wrong. Maybe the Bruins will win a bunch of games.
So I don't know if you saw this, when they traded Weegar, Aaron Ekblad, who was Weegar's pairing partner, gave an interview and he was like despondent that they traded Mackenzie Weegar. And he was like, this is more than hockey for me. And I'm like, oh my Jeez. God, this is their now best defenseman.
This is their Christian Vasquez trade.
And it's like, wow, I would wonder if this would fracture the room a little bit, right? You get Makhachuk and he's awesome. I'm not saying he's not, but I do wonder if there's more than just surface level here with losing a guy like Weegar. And especially another thing too, is they got rid of Andrew Brunette, their head coach, and they brought in Paul Maurice. And Paul Maurice's teams are fine, but I associate Paul Maurice with underachieving at the same time.
Oh, he's never won, has he?
No, like he ran Winnipeg. He ran Carolina, and I remember those teams always being like, this team should be better than they are. Why are they not as good as they are? So I'm like, I don't know.
He strikes me as a David Quinn. Like, he can interview well. You know, he's good at getting jobs.
Yeah, and maybe I'm totally wrong, and Winnipeg overachieved, but I don't know. Like, they were never anything that was like, oh, wow, okay, they're legit. Oh, no, I'm worried about them. I never felt that with any of his teams. He's only been to the third round once since 2012. Like,
man, there were a couple of years in Winnipeg where it looked like they could win the whole thing. Looking at their roster.
Right. So I just look at it and I'm curious. I'm curious where that goes.
That's true. I mean, like, yeah, when they had like Blake Wheeler and Patrick Laine and Connor Hellebuck playing at a Vezina level, and like Jacob Trouba and like those guys, you know, when they had all those guys, I feel like they should have made a cup final, you know?
Yeah.
I think it was Nashville that beat them one year where I thought Winnipeg was going to win. I mean, we're going on a hockey tangent now, but yeah, Paul Maurice is a
I remember, achiever. I remember their big, the year that everyone thought, oh, here it comes, they're going to do it, was the year that they lost to Vegas in the Western Conference Finals. You know, Vegas, the Misfits, right? Like that Misfits team beat them, and I want to say it was five games. I don't think it like went particularly deep either. Mm. So you know, and that was a great Winnipeg team. But after coming up short there, they lose in the first round. I think they lose in the bubble in the qualifying round, and then they're done. That's it. It's over. So that's kind of how I look at Paul Maurice. I don't look at him as like a cup winning coach, in my opinion. So maybe I'm wrong. We'll see. But I think the door is open for them to potentially, the Bruins, that is, to win this division.
I mean, the way you've laid it out, the Bruins are definitely should be considered like a dark horse or something in the division. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, like now, yeah, it's like what Tampa's turning into. It's like the Bruins right now, kind of, you know,
right,
they're going to find out soon that they can't. You can't win a cup with just Stamkos, Hedman, Vasilevsky, and like, you know, a bunch of, you know, retreads and replacements and like, you know, spare parts, you know? So I feel like that's what Tampa's turning into. And Florida feels like they could squander their whole, like, whatever they've been building here. Hopefully, I mean, for their sake, that Machachuk is that good that he can, you know, be the guy that brings them to the cup. That's basically what needs to happen here.
So, yeah, and I will say that.
It's a thing to watch in that division, for sure.
I think playing with Barkov is an upgrade over playing with Lindholm. Now the question is, who's the Johnny Gaudreau, right, that helps him?
Elias Lindholm, just in case people got confused there.
Oh, what did I say, Hampus?
No, you just said Lindholm.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Just in case people were wondering who.
No. So I look at that, like, you know, Kachuk had a great year. He was also part of a great line. Now, you know, I like Barkov. It's just, who's that winger, right? Who's the Johnny Hockey that's going to help Kachuk be, you know, what he was a year ago as well? So I think you need all three pieces of that line to be working for you. So we'll see.
This has been good Florida Panthers talk, but
this is Atlantic Division talk.
Yeah, no, right. That's true. If you want the Bruins to win the division, if you think they have any hope winning, you got to look at Florida. You got to pay good attention to them. So that's good. Okay, but that's a lot. That was a lot of good Bruins talk. I feel like we were sort of overdue for that. But it makes sense because you know, he's starting to go to events there and camp's coming up. Hockey season's going to be upon us before we know it. I'm getting so excited. I love hockey so much.
That's the best.
I'm always happy when it's back, even if we have questions and concerns, questions, thoughts, concerns, as my old middle school teachers used to say about the Bruins. So, all right. I think we should take a break here, though, because we're running out on the stupid Zoom thing.
All right.
So I'm going to have to restart the stupid meeting. But I do have some football stuff I want to get to.
You want to talk about carrying your love with team? Me. Yeah.
All right. This is the Sports Hub Underground. So we're going to stick to sports and we're going to come back. We're going to talk some football. We'll be right back.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We're back. All right, Ty, you want to talk about the local football team?
Yeah, I mean, let's all right. Get depressed.
No, yeah, no. 0-17. I know it's happening.
On the table.
It's technically on the table. It's technically possible. Yeah, I mean, like, obviously, problems that we saw in the summer carried over. There's definitely bright spots to pull out of that game. But I mean, like, at the end of the day, like, I never really had that much confidence they were actually going to win that game. They always lose in Miami, mm-hmm. So it's just hope that they can correct those ugly mistakes, like the Mac Jones getting strip sacked and leaving that blocker untouched. You know, that's the kind of stuff we saw early in camp, and I thought they had maybe corrected that. But you know, showed up in a real game and it really cost them on that play. And the defensive one, like, I don't know. I feel like it's sort of unfair to Kyle Duggar to put that whole play on him. And like, I give him credit for saying it was just a bad play by me. And it, of course, he could have made a better play to tackle the receiver and not let him get run by. But I mean, like, why are they playing like a single high safety with like 8-9 guys in the box on 4th-and-1 at the very end of the half? Like, it felt to me like they thought they were going to, you know, get a turnover or, you know, sack him, get a loss of yardage, something like that. Like, I don't know why they would vacate that much of the deep part of the field. And like, you know, I personally would have erred toward the side of just preventing a touchdown rather than like not giving it. It felt like they didn't want to give up the 7 yards or whatever they needed. I think it was 4th-and-7. Like, they didn't want to give up the 7 yards and then they kick a field goal. It's like, well, oops, you gave up 7. So, I mean, game came down to those two plays, and like, it used to be the Patriots making those plays that made the difference in a game, which is extremely frustrating. So yeah, like, offensively, still the same problems that we saw over the summer. I don't know, but are you surprised that they, are you surprised at anything you saw?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised. I mean, I'm sure we'll get to one of the things that surprised me the most, and it's kind of the talk of the town right now, but it did feel, and I'm curious how you feel about this sort of opinion, this take, whatever. It did feel like they beat themselves in a lot of ways. like the mistakes they were making was like, well, that can't happen if you're going to win in Miami. That can't happen if you're going to win in Miami. Like, I found myself saying that a lot. And I'm still not very impressed with the Dolphins. I mean, maybe they get better over time, but I like, I was just like, oh, okay, they're a team, but you're kind of making it easy for them. You know, between penalties, miscommunication that we talked about. I mean, you know, is it a different game if that Waddle touchdown like doesn't happen? Like, probably, obviously, but you know, those are things you can't afford. Again, to your point, can't happen in Miami if you're going to win in Miami, right? So
can't happen anywhere.
Yeah,
those plays that can't happen in any game ever. This is the type of game the Patriots used to win because the other team would do something crazy like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give up those crazy turnover touchdowns, you know.
Yeah.
Backbreaking mistake, like they let the Patriots recover the onside kick rather than the Patriots making the special teams mistake. So it's like, it's frustrating that, like, this is where I think that the drain on the coaching staff has sort of come back to hurt Bill Belichick, who I just think he feels like he can just do everything. I mean, like, I don't know. I think when he had more brain power, they looked better. They were more consistent. They did all the little things right. And I feel like that's the real rebuild that's sort of hurting them. Like, I don't think it's the roster, which makes it extra frustrating, which is I think they have good players on offense. They're not executing properly. And they think, it feels like they're too thinned out on, especially on the offensive side of the ball. You know, and I don't think just anybody can coach any position, which is Bill's opinion. I mean, I just respectfully disagree with him on that one. There's a reason Josh McDaniels, for better or worse, say whatever you want about him, but he is a good offensive coordinator. He does know how to coordinate an offense.
And, yeah,
you know, I think if they had him and Brian Flores running the defense, I think they would look like a much, much different team right now. And I keep saying frustrating, but that's just that's the only word I can come up with.
Yeah, that's how I felt, though, like sort of watching the offensive line still have all the problems it was having. It was like, come on, like this can't be happening still. You know, if it was happening in camp and you said for 2 weeks, we had a good 2 weeks, two week of practice. You know, we think we're getting better. Like, you can't have someone just completely wallop your quarterback, completely untouched, uncontested, just a wide open lane, right? To just absolutely smacking Mac Jones to the earth's core, basically. And what's frustrating for me about that, you know, to borrow your phrase there, is that what are they going to do? Are they going to get 75-year-old Dante Scarnecchia back out of retirement again? Because, like, hey, man, we really still need your help. Like, can you please do it? So, you know, so that's how I'm looking at it. Like, all right, what's the solution here? Because I think, you know, you kind of sounded this alarm. It was the opposite of the alarm that a lot of people were sounding, but I think I think it made the most sense where you said, I'm not worried about Matt Patricia coaching the offense. I'm worried about him coaching the offense and the offensive line, because that's a lot of work to do. That's a lot of work on your plate.
He's the senior football advisor, which is essentially like assistant head coach.
Right. So like, that's a lot on his plate, to your point. And if you're going to have issues on both the offensive front and the offensive line, it's like, hey, man, I think I kind of want you only doing one job right now, if that's okay. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah, I mean, like Patricia said himself when he talked the other day, it's like, I'm grateful to Bill that he's giving me all these opportunities. And it's like, yeah, I mean, obviously, you're looks like you're being groomed to be the next head coach. So obviously, if I'm him, I'm happy. But like, how could Bill possibly be happy with how the offense is performing? With his like best friend running the whole thing, and coaching the offensive line, which I guess I want to credit. I think Phil Perry mentioned this, that they had Billy Yates, who's like the assistant offensive line coach, up in the booth, like overseeing the game, and then they had him out on the sidelines in the second half. And so it's like, what is going on here? And like, I don't know, maybe they're going to prove us all wrong and go on one of their classic, like, vintage Patriot win streaks, like they even had for a time last year. And like, maybe they figure it out. Maybe they start like, you know, 1-3, 2-3 or something again. And then all of a sudden they rip off 10 wins in a row. You know, like maybe they'll do that. I'm still not out on Bill. Like, I feel like Bill could still somehow figure that out. But like, I can't, the staff was already in a rebuild and then they lost Josh McDaniels. And then McDaniels took a bunch of guys with him as well. His offensive coordinator, Mick Lombardi, and not that the Raiders had like a great game last Sunday offensively, but like he could have been the offensive coordinator here. You know, like I don't get why it had to be Patricia. Like, I feel like if Matt Patricia was just the senior football advisor, you know, maybe that would be okay if they, and then they just, you know, have Billy Yates coach the offensive line. But that's a Patricia guy too, by the way. Billy Yates, the Matt Patricia guy. So I don't know how I feel about him. And I always had confidence in Bill when it came to offensive line, but like, it just feels like he's leaving it all to Patricia. And like that strip sack I put mainly on the coaching. Cause like, I get like the setting the right protections usually is the quarterback and the center usually need to be on point. They need to be on the same page and be on point with setting all the protections. But if they were being coached properly, I'm convinced that they would be setting the right protections. So David Andrews is an extremely smart player, and smarts is Mac Jones's strength. I don't think those guys are, you know, I assume that they're not being coached properly and then going out and just screwing it up. I think it's coming from the coaching that the screw ups are happening, you know? And like, I want to give Mike McDaniel a little bit of credit, because like those two big plays, like, I mean, it was a good call to blitz that safety. They obviously didn't see it coming, you know? And the Jalen Waddle play was a good, he went for it, really went for it. They saw that, you know, he probably saw that they had the one deep safety, you know, so let's take a shot. So, I mean, I give him credit for that.
One thing I want to ask you about.
They had familiarity with Josh Boyer, used to be here. So, like, obviously he had a little familiarity with the Patriots. But, I mean, I don't know. I guess McDaniel probably has a chance to be a good, decent head coach. And I can't say the same for the other head coach in Denver, which we can get to. But, let me get to the silver lining with the Patriots. Okay. Is that the defense, I thought, had a good game, other than that one mistake, which, again, I put on the coaching, lack of preparation, lack of awareness, that sort of thing. But I think otherwise, I think they look like they're in decent shape against these Shanahan McVay style offenses, which is, I think, something we haven't really been able to say about them in recent years. You know, ever since these, you know, offenses have become the vogue in the league, like now every other team has a Shanahan disciple or a McVay disciple, and they're all doing the zone stuff and a heavy running game stuff. And I feel like they're equipped to beat an offense like that on defense, which is a good sign, because our concerns were always about the cornerbacks, but it might be better for them that they can figure out these Shanahan style offenses, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I there's nowhere to go but up, right? At least that's the hope here. I also, like I said it when you're entering the season, I can't panic until about a month into the year, see where they're at, see if things are improving. I would also say that week one was kind of a weird one. There's a lot of upsets, a lot of teams that were either hanging with teams or pulling off upsets that I was a little bit surprised by. The one thing that concerns me about the Patriots is, you know, the 7 points, right? Like,
right.
You know, no,
it's like all about the offense.
Right. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I was curious, how come, is it just the Patriots thing that they're never going to have a true number one, you know, again, this is probably overused because of fantasy, but like a number one running back? Because I was surprised that the split between Stevenson and Damian Harris was what it was, because I thought Harris had the legs, was going. I didn't feel the same about Stevenson, but their split was nearly even, I thought. And that was a little bit surprising to me.
They never really had that guy that's like, I mean, even capable of that.
Right.
I mean, they never drafted a guy that went to another team and suddenly became like this bell cow. You know what I mean? It's not like Sony Michel went to the Rams and all of a sudden he became this, like, you know, dominant guy. The last one I could think of that was like a true bell cow was LeGarrette Blount. Remember that run he had? Not literally like the streak he had, hot streak he had in, I think, 2012, 2013, might have been both years. Mm-hmm. Or like late in the season, they I think it was 2013, because they couldn't, the passing game was struggling so much, they sort of morphed into a running offense in the second half of the year. And LeGarrette Blount went off. He had a couple games where he had like almost 300 total yards when you count like return yards and stuff. Like he was dominant for a while. And so, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I think it just comes down to whether, I think they always prefer the committee approach, because to preserve guys like that, because they, you know, that's how they ended up with Cordarrelle Patterson at running back, is not having the depth and not being able to spread the ball around, so to speak. So,
yeah,
what they've changed this year, though, is that whoever's on the field stays on for three downs, if that makes sense. So it's like Damian Harris gets a full drive, then Stevenson gets a full drive and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I look at it, like I look at Sunday's game and you know, you take out I think it was a 12 yarder. I think that was Harris's long on the ground. Even if you take that out, he averaged 4.5 yards per carry. You know, Stevenson's, I think, was clugging along at, I think, 3. Like, you know, that yard and a half is a difference when you can't really get anything else going offensively, in my opinion. So, you know, I just look at that and say, if you got the guy who's a bell cow, maybe you got to reverse course a little bit here and say, all right, we got nothing going for us. This is one thing that is going for us. Let's rely on it a little bit more. So yeah. Just something that I noticed, and I was curious, you know, your take on it as someone who sees this team more, knows how the personnel and the usage is kind of deployed, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they've been that everyone gets three downs, but it's still a committee, that sort of thing. Like, I don't mind like a change of pace. You know what I mean? The days of one guy getting 30 carries is sort of over anyway.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. But like talent wise, I think Stevenson has a chance to sort of be that guy where like Damian Harris might not even be here next year. And so, you know, they might be looking at Stevenson as potentially that guy that's just the bell cow that plays as many snaps as possible. I think speaking of LeGarrette Blount, he kind of reminds me of him.
Mm.
But I thought Harris had a really good game. Damian Harris had a really good game. I thought he looked good.
That's what I mean.
He looked good in the zone. He looked good in the zone stuff. I think that's what it was. You know, the plays where you just make one cut and then, you know, find your lane and run. And I thought he did really, really well at that. But obviously the offense didn't do as well once they got off the scripted drive, which is like, I know that first drive was exciting, but it is the scripted drive. And like, you know, at least we know that they could script a drive like that. They have plays that they feel good about and can go out there and just execute it. But I think Miami like slightly made some adjustments as the game went along and they started to, you know, make more plays up front. And so, I mean, 7 points is what it is, you know? So, I mean, like, it's not like you have much to feel good about offensively, but you feel like if they could just get to an offense that scores 23, you know, can you score 23, 24? You know, you win that game in Miami. That's the frustrating part. And, you know, and just, it's just annoying that I feel like they have the players to do it, but they're not being coached well enough. I just think that's the reality. And I know that it's been beaten to death, but, you know, we're seeing it in real games that count now. So I think you have to talk about it as long as they haven't figured it out. I think they still can, but we're waiting.
So do we want to get to the talk of the week and namely one player on offense who is not getting what he got last year, and that's Kendrick Bourne.
Oh, I was going to say, who could you possibly be talking about? All right, yeah.
So Kendrick Bourne on Sunday plays two snaps. Little Jordan Humphrey played more snaps on offense than Kendrick Bourne did, which is not what I expected.
That's some good blocks in there, little Jordan Humphrey.
Sure. So anyways, not exactly what I want to hear about a guy who's playing more than one of your better pass catchers.
He played really well within 1 yard of the line of scrimmage. I'll give him for that.
And so with his two snaps, he catches a 41-yard pass. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one going, oh, that would have been helpful. Maybe in the first half, a little bit earlier in the game. What the hell is going on here, Matt? Can you please tell me what the hell is going on?
I think Patricia has a thing with him. It's what it feels like. It feels that was clearly a punishment. You know, like I know Bill said after the game, no, it's just worked out that way. Two snaps, that's how it worked out. Come on. I could see if he played like 10, 12, 15, you know, 14 snaps and he said, well, you know, you got the fourth most snaps of receiver and, you know, it just worked out that would make sense to me. And I was expecting him to be the number four guy. Everyone was expecting him to be fourth in the pecking order based on how the reps had gone. And he definitely had a bad summer and all that. So everyone was expecting him to get the fourth most snaps at receiver. Nobody was expecting two. Two snaps and you don't play until the fourth quarter. I'm sorry, that is punitive. That's like, and to me, it's excessive. It's excessively punitive.
Yes.
But I tried to like take a positive from that 41-yard catch because you juxtapose that with Nelson Agholor catching the ball and fumbling. And that like those two plays like happened not far apart from each other. And so that was like, maybe that could be a turning point for Bourne. Maybe he'll, you know, sharpen up and start to practice better. Cause it's obviously like we all saw him throwing punches in the brawl with the Panthers. It's not like this is a total mystery, you know, like that he hasn't been making as many plays as the other receivers. And he lost his mind in that joint practice fight. And so like we've seen it, you know, out there in front of us, him having trouble out there. But I mean, like, it just feels like it's gone on too long, you know? And like the things that got reported that he was in trouble for happened weeks ago. So it's like, what the hell is going on here still? And I mean, I don't know. It just feels like maybe I'm just reading into it too much because I'm not a fan of how it's gone with Matt Patricia and all these roles so far. But I just feel like Matt Patricia's, you know, running the offense. And so like that was his decision. I think that's what Tommy Curran reported, is that it was a Patricia decision to basically bench Bourne until the fourth quarter. And you know, like, that is shoving it in the guy's face. That's just like telling me, you know, you're sitting. That's not like, I think it's just disingenuous to say that that's how it worked out. But yeah,
I think he showed contrition. I think he was like when he messed up, he was like, yeah, whatever. And then after the game, he's like, I'm waiting for my chance. He was still smiling.
Smiling. You can tell that he's forcing a smile while he's talking. But like, that's, you know.
And Matt, what I would say is this, is that this is a guy who was one of Mac Jones's favorite targets a year ago. He's friends with Mac Jones. They are clearly tight. They are clearly tight. And I don't know if this offense can afford to send regular season messages for preseason violations. Let's just call him Matt, right? With a guy who had a 79% catch rate a year ago, 79% catch rate.
That's high.
That's really high. And so I look at it that way and I go, you can't afford to bench this guy. Maybe you could if you had Tyquan Thornton and he was healthy. Like maybe there's more of a rhyme and reason if that's the case. But I don't know. If you're going to run the two tight end sets and Jonnu Smith is not going to be a factor and Nelson Agholor is going to be fumbling the ball, get Kendrick Bourne out there. I want him out there. I want a guy who's going to be dependable, reliable, and make some plays. And you know, Devontae Parker, hey, man, you're the one who's talking about how you make him 80-20. Make him 80-20 then. Back it up. Because
yeah, that was the 20, apparently. When
yeah, exactly. So
Mac didn't, it was underthrown, but Parker could have, and Parker was held, but, you know, got away with that. But, like, you know, could have put a little more fight into that one. We saw him all summer jumping and leaping and going up and getting the ball. So, I mean, like, I was surprised that, like, against a guy that he was familiar with, Xavier Howard, who I guess apparently owns him.
Right.
You know, practicing all that. But I don't know. That was arguably the most disappointing performance on Sunday was Devontae Parker. You know, they had the one catch, played almost every snap, which I was expecting to play a lot, but I was expecting to make some plays. It was your former team that traded you to the division. To the team that you're playing week one, like you weren't, he had to be motivated. There had to be some kind of motivation to stick it to his former team. What the hell happened? Like that was disappointing. And like, it's too bad that they didn't recognize early enough in the game that like, we got to give Bourne a shot, or they were just saying, nope, screw him. We're keeping him on the bench. That feels like what they said. We're going to stay the course with Parker here. But I think Parker barely showed like one catch, despite all his playing almost every snap. And Agholor fumbling, you know, like, I feel like you got to give Bourne more. Bourne's got to cut into those guys' snaps. And apparently, like, the same guys that are reporting these things that are going on with Bourne saying that his usage is just going to go up. And like, maybe that's Robert Kraft going to Bill and be like, what the hell's going on here? This, you know, we're paying him good money. He was good last year. Why isn't he playing? Can we do this?
Right.
But yeah, like I guess like, yeah, Bourne like McDaniels and like, he's mad that Josh McDaniels is gone and he probably seems like he had a lot of trouble adjusting to the new setup and the new offense and Matt Patricia coaching him. And I guess he didn't handle that well, but I mean, I don't know. He went out there and he was second on the team in receiving yards with exactly one catch on one target. So it's like, he's still looking at Bourne's way when he's on gotta have a place. And I mean, I know it was preseason, but I think it was, was it Vegas where it was fourth down and Mac Jones threw it to Bourne on fourth down? And so, I mean, I know it was preseason, but that still told me that Mac still looks at Kendrick Bourne and sees like a guy that I can trust on a play where we absolutely need to make it. I want to throw it to him. So, I mean, yeah, it's it's become very bizarre, especially after they Malcolm Butler'd him in that game against the Dolphins. But I think we're going to see more of Bourne going forward. I think we have to.
Yeah, it only came at the expense of a regular season loss of a game that you probably could have won, which is annoying. That's annoying because you can't afford to spitefully send messages because you're not that good of a team. And I don't mean that like an insulting way. I mean that you're in a really good AFC and you need every win you can get. And if you're going to self-sabotage because of what happened in week 2 of the preseason, I just can't get on board with that. Right. I just don't think that's a good idea.
This isn't Tom Brady making up for it by throwing for 500 yards and 3 touchdowns with a fully loaded, group,
Right.
You don't have the 2000 Ravens on defense either. It's like, I think their defense is going to be much better than people give it credit for, but they weren't going to give up 3 or 0 points most likely on the road. Can't bank on that. You can't bank on winning 7-3. Can you?
No, you can't.
Yeah, the 2000 Ravens, maybe.
Yeah, and also, by the way,
pull it off. Ray Lewis and Ed Reed—that's they need.
They need more dancing and potential murder. I quickly
need more bloody white suits.
I want to apologize for Jonnu Smith catching a stray there. I actually thought he had a pretty good game on Sunday, but nevertheless, I just think that they need more Kendrick Bourne. So sorry for it. Sorry for Jonnu Smith catching a stray. I didn't mean to do that.
Wait, what did you say about Jonnu Smith?
No, I said if you're going to run these two tight end sets and Jonnu Smith isn't going to be a major factor, I basically just said they need more Kendrick Bourne based on the personnel. Like I want him out there more, but I actually thought that Jonnu Smith had a decent game on Sunday.
I was going to say Jonnu Smith made plays when they put the ball in his hand. There's another guy that I wish they could get involved more, but I don't know. Maybe I was hoping he was starting to figure it out. We didn't see anything of Hunter Henry in the passing game. I mean, he made one good catch on the opening drive, I believe. Mm-hmm. But we need to see more of everybody, And like I don't want to let Mac Jones off the hook either, because he wasn't accurate on his deep balls, and I think he's still working through playing with pass rushers in his face. And I know there's certain plays where, like, what can you do? Like the strip sack, guys getting in untouched like that. But he just wasn't – I don't know if it might not be his fault, but I just feel like he wasn't accurate enough on the plays where, like, he really needed to force the ball down the field and make plays. So, I mean, maybe that's just his physical limitation. But, if he wants to be great, he's got to be pinpoint, and he wasn't exactly – that but I think he would admit that too.
Yeah I would agree. So how do you look at Pittsburgh, and it tying that in, how do you look at the rest of the league right now through week 1?
I mean, I feel like Pittsburgh is going to be it's going to be similar to the Miami game, where it's going to come down to who makes a big play on defense, or who comes up with the one game-changing big play on offense, or even special teams. I don't know, I feel like it's going to be tight and close. Another than that, there's going to be a couple big plays that decide the game, which is a lot of football games are decided that way. So hopefully the Patriots can get back on the winning side of games like that. It feels like that's been drying up in the post-Tom Brady era, unfortunately. I feel like they have the roster to do it. I just don't know if they have the coaching to do it. And like, what gives me hope about the Pittsburgh game, Ty, is that the familiarity. I just feel like their defense isn't exactly the same as it always was when Brady would shred them. And I feel like Brian Flores being on Pittsburgh might be a big factor. But I feel like this is a game where they're going to know what they need to do going into it. It was actually at Gillette earlier today, and I asked Matt Judon, did it feel familiar to him, going back and watching the tape? Because obviously he was with the Ravens, and he played the Steelers a bunch of times, probably more than any other Patriot, I would assume. And he said, yeah, he gave me just enough of what I was looking for, Ty. He said the players are the same. No, the plays are the same, but the players are different. So, like, he's looking at the scheme here and saying, okay, I see what they're doing there. I know what I need to do here. And, like, not that Judon's role is all that complex. Maybe really just gets the quarterback for him.
Right.
But, like, that tells me that, like, I don't think it's going to be much different from the Steelers that the Patriots are used to seeing. So, like, I feel like on both sides, this is a game they're going to go into it knowing what they have to do. And the question is, can they execute it? And so it might be tough being on the road with the crowd and all that. Obviously, the offense is what we got to look for, because they're going up against a very, very talented defense. And I know they lost TJ Watt, which was pretty funny to me, by the way. They're like, No, just injected him with some stuff. He'll be back in 6 weeks. It'd tear the whole pectoral.
Get that super soldier serum going in.
The torn boob for TJ Watt. But reminder, we talked, I think, last week about like predictions for the awards. Mm-hmm. Micah Fitzpatrick, to me, was a good choice for Defensive Player of the Year prediction. That's who I should have said. He had a huge first game against Cincinnati. So it's going to be interesting to see how they use him. Because I feel like him on Devontae Parker makes the most sense, but he is like a free safety, I thought. So I don't know. Like they're a little thin at cornerback. And so I think, or like they're not as good at cornerback as the Dolphins are. So I feel like the Patriots receivers are going to get open more. And just the question is, can they block up front? Which, you know, it's a huge question mark. And I think Pittsburgh is going to blitz more. So like they got to be ready for that blitz stuff. I'm sorry. They like whether it's Mac or David Andrews, Matt Patricia, whoever the hell, they got to get their, you know what, together. When it comes to protection, because I think if they can protect Mac, they're going to be able to scheme guys open because they're so familiar with this team. And so that's my thought on Pittsburgh. You asked me about the NFL too, right?
Yeah.
Like Nathaniel Hackett, he obviously sucks. We already know.
He's gone within 2 years.
We already know. He sucks now. Maybe he'll be good in his second head coaching stint, but like that right there is, I'm so glad this happened in week one. You can't just go get a quarterback and you're fine. You know what I mean? Like the coaching can undo something good because the Broncos do have a really good roster, but that right there, I think Nathaniel Hackett's inexperience as a head coach and managing games is going to cost them one game, you know? So there you go.
And the other part of it too,
you can't just crown a guy before he ever coaches a game.
Dude, even after the loss, Joe Buck was like, I think Nathaniel Hackett's going to be an amazing coach in this league for a long time. But what is he doing? I was like, how can you say that? How does anything you saw tonight indicate that that is the case? What, like, people just crown these guys, dude. It's unbelievable.
It's
like,
so weird.
It's just bizarre. And so, yeah, terrible. Not great. I would say out of week one thing I took away, I kind of like Seattle. I like this underdog Seattle team now. I'm not a big Pete Carroll guy, but the way that – first of all, the fans can boo Russell Wilson if they want. He basically forced a trade, didn't want to be there, and I understand there are reasons for all that, but the dude was throwing to Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. Pretty good tandem he had there, I would say. Mm. Like I don't know what more he really wanted.
I say no, he won you a Super Bowl. You gotta cheer him one time. And then
boo. Boo,
the guy
boo,
won
boo.
You a Super Bowl. No, you gotta respect the guy who won you a Super Bowl.
Did he win them a Super Bowl, or did the Legion of Boom win them a Super Bowl? Because that's how I would look at that.
That's a fair point.
And
that's a fair listen, point. But they only scored. Like,
I think there's a little bit of heat there.
They only scored like 16 points on defense in that game.
Yeah, of course. I think that there's a little bit of heat there. I don't know if you saw Richard Sherman's tweet after the game, but he was like,
no, I haven't seen it because he blocked me.
Oh no. Well, what'd you do to him? Why you do
nothing?
That?
Nothing.
I wonder if there's a little bit of Russell Wilson, you know, maybe not being the most well-liked person. Like,
he definitely seems like an unlikable kind of, like, he seems kind of Aaron Rodgers like, where he's just kind of like a nut. He doesn't act like a real human. He just doesn't know how to act. Like around, that's what it seems like to me. I don't know.
Right. I don't know, man. Like it's interesting. There's a lot of chatter out of that game that I found really interesting. Like Shelby Harris, I think, who got traded from Denver to Seattle, was chirping about Hackett. Like people don't like this guy. It's kind of fun.
I mean, what were his credentials? Having right. Aaron Rodgers.
Let's ride or whatever he says, like whatever they say.
Yeah. Might as well give him the Lombardi trophy now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, like the Bengals losing was interesting to me, you know, and it's like, this is where like, we got to be careful and realize that we're in sort of a bubble. You know, we have all these concerns about the Patriots because we're so hyper-focused on them. But like that makes us, we sort of convince ourselves that the Patriots are this laughing stock and they're like terrible and every other team is perfect and has no problems. I just don't think that's the case. I think other teams are going to have problems. Other teams aren't going to be as good as people think. And like, and teams like the Patriots could be better than certain people think. And I feel like I still have enough confidence and Bill Belichick, and that they still have a good enough roster that they're going to be in the mix, that they're still going to be in the mix for playoffs. And, you know, they might screw themselves with making dumb plays like they did against Miami, but the Patriots aren't this laughing stock. All these other teams, they're going to have issues that they're going to need to work through. It looks like the Bengals are going to have a bit of a Super Bowl hangover. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. But I still think we're going to have a football season today.
I agree. Especially with that, we've talked about it before, but that schedule gets real light right in the middle there, where you can pile up some wins. So I expect that to be the case.
I expect that to be the case too. I expect another close game in Pittsburgh, decided by another couple big plays. So hopefully that goes the Patriots away.
I think Pittsburgh too helps, because you're basically going to be asked to go against an offense that potentially has a wounded, you know, running back. And Najee Harris, we know he's hurting right now. And Mitch Trubisky threw for less than 200 yards and had a completion percentage around 50%, a little bit above 50%. So not exactly a world-beating offense. So you should be able to hang with them, I think, as well.
I think the Patriots defense is going to have a good game. You know, we'll see how the secondary holds up against those receivers. But I think up front, they're going to make some plays. So it's going to be close. The Patriots might have to win on defense, but we'll see. All right. We still got to do the big three.
One more break.
We're going to take one more break here, and we will come back and we'll do the big three. We'll be right back.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We're back. Ty, it's time for the big three. We're going to do the big three sports uniform numbers
that we would want. Yeah,
that I would want. Yeah, I think we could say the best number, numbers we would like.
The best way to phrase it is that if you were a pro athlete, you lived out your dreams, you got to pick any number. What are the three that you would pick?
Right. Yeah. We don't want to go the best players that wore certain numbers. Necessarily.
Exactly. Yeah,
but
exactly.
I do think it might sort of go in that direction on my end. So, all right, but I'll let you start.
All right. Do we want to exclude numbers that we wore regularly?
To pick whatever you want.
All right. So for me, it was number 88. I got to wear this number once for football. Loved this number. Eric Lindros, Terry Glenn. Huge fan of 88. But yes, that would be I was playing a little before Pastrnak was alive, I'm pretty sure. No, he's born 96. So 88 was always my go-to if I could have it. If I couldn't, I'd try to find some variation of it.
Oh, gross. I was playing hockey before David Pastrnak was born? That is gross. You said 96? Oh, my
God.
That's
when he was born, yeah.
Oh, God. I played hockey for 2 years before Pastrnak was alive? Oh, my God. I'm a fossil, Ty. That's sickening.
Nah. I hope we got that because you froze. And all I heard was, oh, God, and then silence, and then sickening. So I kind of like it. A little dramatic pause. Why not?
Yeah, we'll see. Well, I guess we'll see how it comes out on the recording. Yeah, it just told me I have an unstable internet connection. All right, well, I'll get us out of here as soon as we can. For my first number, I'll pick 7. I don't think I ever actually wore 7, but I just think it's just the ultimate sports jersey number. It's a great quarterback number. It's a great, centerman or a top defenseman number. Ray Bourque, obviously, Phil Esposito, that's just, I feel like that's the ultimate. That's like lucky number 7. There's nobody's got, who doesn't like the number 7? You probably don't because you don't like.
I know attachment to it, but I like the way it looks on jerseys. So I do see what you mean.
Yeah. And 77 too, but I'll just go with 7 because it's like you are commanding. You're a commanding presence if you wear number 7. You can't just have some stiff wearing number 7, right?
Oh, it's nothing worse. Nothing's worse than when like a number 5 defenseman wearing number 4 or 77. I'm like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah,
you can't have that.
Like I obviously the Bruins, you can't wear 7, but that's like the first number I would pick if I was like the franchise player and then were available. That's what I would go with.
It's a good one. So when I wanted 88 but couldn't have it, I switched to 8 plus 8 equals 16. So 16 was my number 2. And okay. And so I like 16 because Marco Sturm had it. If you want to go back to the 70s, Derek Sanderson had it. Bobby Clark had it. Just a classic kind of number, right? It's like your classic like grinder guy who can kind of maybe score a little bit. Also a good baseball number. It looks good on baseball jerseys, I found. 16 does look good on baseball jerseys. So
Joe Carrigan, 16.
Sure, why not?
All right, Joe Montana, sorry.
Yeah, I just think 16... So 16 is kind of weird for a quarterback. It's kind of weird looking because like it looks almost too bulbous to be a quarterback number.
It's a little, it makes 16 feel like an odd number when a quarterback when they wear it.
But that's mine. I love that.
All right. That's a pretty good pick. I'm trying to think of my favorite player who wore 16. There was someone I'm not thinking of.
Marco Sturm for me.
I don't know. I'll probably think of it.
Darcy Tucker? Were you a big Darcy Tucker guy?
No. I'll probably wake up in a cold sweat thinking about it later tonight. Yeah. All right. My number two pick is 99. Obviously the great one, Wayne Gretzky. Obviously, you know, like Aaron Donald. You know, I feel like if you're a great player, like it's one of the great, great player numbers. Because it's all the way up. You're a 99 in Madden. You know, like you're 99 and you're wreaking havoc out there. It's very stressful on the opponent. Be like, oh, my God, 99 is dominating. Andy wears 99. So it's like, you know, I just feel like that's one of the ultimate numbers.
And, Jason Taylor wore 99, right?
Yes, I believe that's correct. I'm trying to think of Patriots that wore 99. I can't think of any. Was Byron Cowart 99? He might have been. If I were a defensive end, if I were a pass rusher, I'd want to wear 99. So that's my second pick.
That's a good one. 99, I think of Manny Ramirez in L.A. That's like what I think of. Like, I know that's
dominated.
Such a weird pick, but that's what I think of when I think
of
99.
A full season of when he was in the Dodgers uniform was like 60 home runs and like 180 RBI or something insane.
And it was so annoying because it was just confirmation that he like was dogging it.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, come on, man.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% was dogging it. But he also hit home runs in the World Series. So he made up for it.
Exactly. So I would say, all right. So moving on to number three, ironically, we brought up Manny Ramirez. Number 24. 24. Yeah. Love that number. It's been worn by a ton of greats.
Yeah, big time.
I think of Terry O'Reilly when I think of number 24.
There you go.
I think of him, but I also think of Ty Law, who was like the best cornerback I thought in football for a little while there. So loved him. Loved 24. It was nice because Ty Law was the first athlete that had the same name as me. So I was like, this guy's the best. So I was I was a big fan of him. So yeah,
24 feels like it might have the highest number of great players who wore it. You know, like between Manny Ramirez and all these great cornerbacks and all that. So that is definitely a great pick. Let me think for a second before I make my final selection. This is a big one. All right, I will go with 18. 18 is what my dad wore at BU. Boston University hockey legend Steve Dolph. You can see he is literally painted on the wall at Aganis Arena Tech. You put some respect on that Dolph name, unlike all these a-holes that keep mispronouncing it or misspelling it, especially. It's like, it's not that hard, guys, for Christ's sake. But like that's a number I would have worn if I could have had it. But like 18 usually is taken up by, you know, good players. So that would be tough. Was it a Nathan Horton 18? You know,
that's right.
Peyton Manning 18, obviously. Matthew Slater 18. So there you go. I'd wear 18 in honor of Matthew Slater, in fact. So that's my third pick.
I love that. So that wraps it.
That wraps it up.
Any honorable mentions for you?
I'll give 27 an honorable mention because 27 was like my number. That was like I wore it at like one of my career year was like in squirts or something. You know, I was like a point per game guy and I was like one of the top six forward and I wore 27. And for some reason, I enjoyed 27. I don't know why I gravitated toward it. So like that is like the number that if seven weren't available, I'd just be like, all right, give me 27.
Yeah, so
that's my honorable mention.
I think for me, baseball, I always wore number five because of Nomar and I played shortstop and third base. Mm. So I was like, all right, number five. Another one for me would be number 11. I was born the 11th, so that's why. Number 44. I always like that. I like
44
like
double, is a good one.
I like double numbers, like yeah. like 11, 33, like 44. Yeah, like 88. Like I just like the way those look on jerseys. I wish more NHL players wore 66, honestly. Like it's not retired. Mario Lemieux wore it, but like you can still wear it. It's not actually retired.
Are they afraid of besmirching the great Mario Lemieux?
I think that only is one guy.
Nobody wears 66.
I think the last guy I saw wearing it was Josh Hosang, and that was the last, and I think that's like the last and only guy I've seen wear it.
And nobody's seen him since.
Basically, like Lou Lamoriello was like, you got to change that number. I think when Lou took over as GM, that was one of the things he did. He was like, you can't wear 66. It's like, come on, dude, grow up. You didn't even GM Lemieux. He just whipped your ass every year with the Penguins.
Right. That feels like that's what's happening. I mean, what number did Gordie Howe wear? Let's retire that. Number four.
Number four was Gordie Howe.
Retire number four, for Christ's
right.
sake. Right. But yeah, 44 is a great defenseman number.
Oh, fantastic number.
Chris awesome Pronger, number. Dennis Seidenberg, 44. Yeah, we morphed into the Dong Report, unfortunately.
I was going to say.
Suck it, Jones.
What's a weird number that you would wear? Like, 63 is a weird number. And Martian made it popular, 74. And now kids are wearing it, which I think is kind of awesome.
I think when I created myself in NHL 2000 or something, for some reason I gave my number 74. So that would be my weird number that I would wear.
Mine would be like 61. I don't know why. I like the way it looks.
A Rick Nash 61.
Yeah, yeah.
Marcus Cannon 61.
It's also the like it's the opposite. It's the reverse of 16.
Yeah, there you go.
So that's how I would do that. Sure, like that's
I should probably wear 72 then.
Yeah, like 1 year 19 16 wasn't available, so I was 19. I flipped the 6 into a 9.
Here's a good one. 81 is a good the reverse of 18. 81's not bad.
No,
I don't know
good.
Why. It just is.
Yeah,
I like 81 more than 80 for some reason.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. Yeah,
I don't like a zero. I don't like a zero on my jersey, personally.
Yeah, you know what it is? Like 10 you know what or 20. It's fattening. It's fattening. Makes you look bigger. That's what it is.
Right. Like, if I were a goalie, I'd rather be 31 than 30.
Yeah, yeah. The best positional player in the NHL who has a zero in his number is Ryan O'Reilly, 90. Looks good. Looks decent. I like that one. That's it. I don't like anyone else who has it.
90 numbers are good. You know what? Tyler Seguin, 91. A Steven Stamkos, 93. I forget what he was.
91.
Sure. Oh, he's 91. Yeah, 91's a good one. The ones are good.
93.
11, 21, 31. Those are good.
I think of 93, and I think of like Doug Waite or like Gilmore. So
Dougie Gilmore, the best player in the world today. All right. Thank you, Don Cherry.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll let you go because I know it's getting late here. We have a late recording this week. But yeah. Well, we'll talk to. I'll see you next week. Hopefully, in the new building. Hopefully, they got the new internet figured out. Any more closing thoughts for us, Ty?
Nope. Can't wait to get away from the website and the internet for like the next week. Very excited.
Excellent. Yes, Ty's gonna have some time off. So hopefully, you can be refreshed, recharged, and get ready for hockey season when he comes back. But we will have another episode next week. We're not going to take a break. But all right, yeah, this is the Sports Hub Underground. Thanks for listening. I love you. You can get us wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, every week at 985thesportshub.com. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.
StageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.